radio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we are speaking to author John Avery Emison in his new book on the Martin Luther King assassination, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King. Welcome to the show, John.
Well, thank you very much, Len. I'm delighted to be here.
Good. You came to my attention at Kennedy's and King website with Jim DiEugenio. And he mentioned, listen, you should help promote this. This is something worthwhile. And that's just what I'm all about. There's so many, you never know if the book is disinformation or bad or this. And so whenever somebody has something worthwhile, I just enthuse to help bring it to the public's attention.
Well, that's great.
Tell me a little bit about your interest in the MLK assassination and then what got you interested enough to write about it.
Well, I live in Alamo, Tennessee, which is a small town about 75 miles northeast of Memphis. And I was a senior in high school in the spring of 1968 when Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. So in one aspect, I sort of lived part of this case, at least from a bit of a distance. Later on, I did my master's degree at Memphis State and lived in Memphis. So anyway, that's the background of the interest part of this. In addition, I had access to some information that other people didn't, because my mother's uncle, my great uncle, Harry S. Avery, was commissioner of correction when James Earl Ray pleaded guilty in Memphis in 1969, and was transported to the main prison in Nashville the same day. My uncle had been an arson investigator. He had worked with the prosecution of Jimmy Hoffa on the Chattanooga jury tampering case, and he was a naturally very inquisitive person, having solved many, many arson cases. And he started his own investigation. He was fired by Governor Buford Ellington in 2 months after Ellington told him to stop it. But I had some conversations in the 90s with him. He died in about, in the 80s and 90s. He died in about 91 or 2, I think, as I recall. And so this led to a period of time where I was a reporter for the Oak Ridger, which is a daily afternoon newspaper in East Tennessee, very close to the former prison, Brushy Mountain, where Ray was incarcerated at the time. And I went and interviewed Ray twice there at Brushy Mountain, and once more on the phone, and an additional time when he had been transferred to the new main prison in Nashville. I believe they call it River Bend Prison. So there's a bit of family connection here as well.
Well, your uncle being an arson investigator, that's when you're really backtracking. You're looking at the footprints and ashes for something and say, how did this turn about? And you were a reporter. So both of you guys naturally inquisitive. I guess having interviewed Ray one would have to say, well, the things this guy was reported to be don't add up.
Oh, no, not at all. You wouldn't hire James Earl Ray to wash your car. He would mess something up. He was not a person who could contemplate, much less plan and carry out any sophisticated crime. He was a ninth grade dropout. He finished the eighth grade. I explain it to people this way. Think of the worst student in your eighth grade class, back whenever that was, years ago. That's Ray. He's not somebody who's going to be able to plan a sophisticated crime. It's just not it. Now, when I met Ray, he had already been in prison for, 12, 13 years, something like that. And he was well-read. It's clear he was well-informed because he had a lot of time to do reading. But even then, you could see he was an uneducated, unpolished person, even though he had had the time to become well-read on certain topics.
Well, let me ask you this. In your conversations with your uncle, what was it was the catalyst? Was there something in particular that piqued your interest that you went, well, there's more to this story?
Oh, yes. In fact, I recount that in my book, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King. It's available on Amazon. It's available at shotwellpublishing.com. My uncle had an appointment in the state capitol in the spring of 1969. He had been asked to come to the governor's office. And these are very elaborate offices, high ceilings, huge foyer to the governor's private office. And he was sitting outside the door. The door was ajar to the governor's office. And he overheard a conversation. And this was before Ray had even pled guilty. And the person on the governor's staff, he could not hear more than the local end of the conversation, of course. But he felt by the context that he was talking that the person on the other end was a high official in the Department of Justice in Washington, perhaps even the Attorney General by the context. And that person on the other end was being assured, don't worry, there's not, Ray is going to plead guilty. There's not going to be a trial. There'll be no evidence put on. And of course, this raises several questions, not the least of which is it's not any business of the governor or anybody's in the governor's office to know or even express an opinion about a pending felony trial in the state, much less to have knowledge of what the defendant is going to do, because the defendant was eventually hounded into pleading guilty by his legal counsel, Percy Forman.
So your uncle was telling you of this conversation that it's already a done deal.
Correct.
Well, how did that get your interest then to go further? Like, what was it about that conversation that you thought, oh, I'm going to have to really dig into this?
Well, I always knew from the early 90s that I was going to do something with this. I didn't know what. and it took me a while to sort of get geared up to do a book on it. But I remember seeing an interview with, what's the guy's name? He wrote mostly on JFK, Case Closed.
Gerald Posner?
Posner. Right. It was an interview. He was being interviewed. Several other people were being interviewed. Hampton Sides, I think, was in the same interview. And I had the TV on and wasn't paying too much attention. I was going back and forth to my laundry. I was doing my laundry. and listening to a little bit, and I'd stop and I'd listen for a few seconds, and I'd think, these guys don't know what they're talking about. And actually, it was that moment that I decided I've got to finish the research, look into all of this, and put all of this down and make it available to the public. So that's kind of an unusual twist of events, but that's literally the catalyst.
Yeah, that's common. You know, these guys are so full of bull that I'm going to drop what I'm doing it and get it. So you had already, you know, having the interest of a reporter, but, you know, a family member who was also an investigator and then anecdotally told you, look at A, B, and C, some of these things aren't right. I don't know what the real story is, but something's rotten in Denmark, as they say.
Well, in addition to that, Lynn, the first time I went to Brushy Mountain Prison and met with Ray, it was a contact visit. This is in the early 90s. Nobody was crazy about all the super duper security stuff that we obsess about today. And he walked in the room. I was escorted to a conference room. He walked in the conference room. We shook hands. I mean, literally a contact visit. The jailer was, maybe 30 feet away at the doorway, wasn't paying anywhere near close attention to what we were saying or that we had shaken hands. There's no problem with that. Ray gave me two cassette tapes. He says, I've had these in my jail cell for 12 years. This is a recording which would have placed it in the late 70s, if it had it 12 years. And this is a recording of your Uncle Harry Avery. And I listened to those recordings several times. And there was a woman interviewing Commissioner Harry Avery. And so I wrote Ray back at the penitentiary. Unfortunately, I've lost this correspondence, and inquired of him, who is the woman who's interviewing Harry Avery? And he wrote back, said, well, that's my wife, Anna Sandu Ray. And to say the least, Harry Avery did not hold back anything or give Ray's wife any discretion that one might tend to give an interviewee's wife. So you had the earlier conversation that my uncle had shared with me. I had this treasure trove of tapes. Harry Avery talks about the suspicious letters that came in the first 2 months to James Earl Ray, including a letter. And I have this in the book again, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King. All that's in the book, including a letter on the letterhead of McGill University in Canada, which, of course, probably all your listeners know was involved in the MK Ultra research. And so you had that and my own interaction with Ray. And then literally the catalyst was listening to these other people on a TV interview with the credibility of, a major network. They're full of it. They're just parroting the government storyline. And that was it. Couldn't hold back after that.
All right. So how long have you been working on the book?
Well, this is my second book on the King assassination. The first one was published in 2014. This one was published in 2023, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King.
And I guess to get into the title then, what are some of the reasons for the title regarding the deep state, as you don't think it was a one deranged man?
No.
Right, I know. I'm just trying to be polite.
Right. No, yes. Of course. And I'm sure your listeners are well informed on on this entire sort of topic, but no one person, not even a small handful of extremely talented and well-placed persons, could keep up the lies that constitute the government story about what happened to in Memphis to Dr. Martin Luther King. It had to be the intelligence community. Now, if they're covering up, then there's more to it than just a felony case in Memphis. And of course, Ray identified the person who directed him and gave him money, which the government, including the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s, said didn't exist. Well, this was the best year of Ray's life. He had money. He had freedom. He was involved in what he knew to be, or was fairly certain to be, some fairly low-level illegal activities. But the guy got to spend part of the winter in Mexico and the rest of the winter in L.A. He had money to buy a one-year-old fastback Mustang, which is pretty hot car back in the day. He didn't have to rob people to get money. He just had to do whatever Raul told him to do. And of course, the government says, well, there was no Raul. That's a figment of the imagination. The money's not a figment. Where'd the money come from? Ray had, as I indicated, this is the best financial year of Ray's life.
Was there an item that was a catalyst for you to exonerate him completely? When I stand back and look at the case, when I found that they found a duffel bag, yeah, including the radio that was from, had his cell number on it.
Right.
When I saw that, I went, oh, no way. No way. I don't care how dumb you are. You would not just drop that off.
No, so, of course not.
What was it for you?
I'll tell you, Lynn, I had an extremely interesting telling interview a number of years ago with Arthur Haynes Jr. in his office in Birmingham. This was after he retired as a circuit judge. And he was very cooperative and very willing to discuss any aspect of the case. He and I have had some other interviews in more recent years. We've more or less stayed in touch with each other, and kind of feel like I think we know each other now. But Haynes told me that Guy Knipe, the man who ran the record shop whose front door alcove was the location of the clunk or the thud or whatever it was of the green, so-called green bundle, because it was in a green bedspread, it had the rifle and, as you indicated, his own transistor radio that had his prisoner number from Missouri. I mean, this guy's got 20 years hanging over his head. Knipe was ready to testify, according to Arthur Haynes Jr. He was ready to testify that he heard the clunk at his front door before he heard gunshots. So the... Now, a really interesting perspective that Judge Haynes had on this was that he said, my dad and I, of course, I think he was only about 26 years old. His father, Arthur Haynes Sr., of course, had been mayor of Birmingham and had a great deal of experience. But he said, we really believed that we were going to get an acquittal because the government's storyline was so fragile that you could attack almost any element of it, and anything that you discredit, the whole story crumbles. And so the murder weapon, of course, it was never proven to be the murder weapon, the alleged murder weapon, the pump action Remington 30-06, can't be two places at the same time. It can't be on Main Street, or I guess that was Second. Let's see, was that South Main or South Second Street? I forgot. I'll have to go back and look. It can't be there where it was found in the alcove to Knipe's front door of his music shop, his record store, and in the hands of an assassin upstairs and a couple of doors down at the same time. So that's the...
When you say the same time, my mind quickly went to a recollection of you. And also you said, if you look into any one thing, the whole case falls apart.
Yes.
At the time, wasn't Ray at a gas station getting air in a tire or something like that?
Yeah.
And the same white Mustang. How could there be a white Mustang at two places?
Right. Well, Lynn, look, there are so many things that are strange about this case. Of course, there has to be because the story's made up. It really didn't happen this the way the government says it happened. But take the fact that the Memphis police were looking for a white man and a white Mustang within minutes of the crime. Of course, they didn't have a name, James Earl Ray. The FBI didn't even have the name James Earl Ray for about 3 weeks. So did local police work solve this crime? You're looking for a white man and a white Mustang before the ambulance even got Dr. King to the emergency room? How is that possible? How is that possible? I think that was within the realm of information that the right person is put in place to introduce into the overall body of events.
Yeah, to obfuscate what really happened.
Absolutely.
And that, thus we get into your title, the deep state assassination, because then the uncomfortable part is, well, if it didn't happen like that, what is the reason for this cover-up?
Yeah. Well, you know, let me get back to Knipe for just a minute, and then I want to talk about the massive police presence in the area of the Lorraine Motel. So, let's deal with that one first. During the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they went back, of course, they interviewed Ray, and they interviewed the police commissioner and the police chief and the prosecutor and the sheriff, Shelby County Sheriff, and all sorts of people. And in addition to a couple of dozen firefighters who were stationed in the fire station immediately adjacent to where all this is happening in just south of downtown Memphis, you had sheriff's deputies, you had some FBI agents. These were people who the House Select Committee interviewed and took statements from, and they said, "Yeah, we were, I was at such and such a location. I was just around the corner, or I was on Second Street, or I was on whichever street." There were three or four dozen lawmen in the immediate vicinity. Now, let's look at one other aspect of some of a part of the officialdom, if you will, that was also present that we didn't know about for 25 years. Assassination happened in 68. The Commercial Appeal, the daily newspaper in Memphis, broke the story in 1993, definitively naming names, direct participant accounts on the record. There were at least two teams of Army intelligence people who were in the vicinity. Now, the Defense Department denied that for 25 years until somebody stepped forward and put that on the record. So let's assume you have an eighth grade dropout who is on the lam. He's had the best year of his life financially. He's got 20 years hanging over his head, plus jail breaks. He would have had to just about elbow his way through police officers, sheriff's deputies, FBI agents to get a shot. It's crazy. The police presence there was massive. And we can thank the House Select Committee on assassinations, HSCA, for bringing that fact out. That's one of the few facts that they didn't get wrong or didn't purposely skew, but it was completely, that part of it was completely overlooked in the national media. Now, let's also, I said I want to talk about two things. Let's also go back to Knipe. When Knipe, the official storyline, as I'm sure you'll recall, is Ray was upstairs in the flop house. He took the shot. He ran down the steps. He ran the length of one business or maybe two businesses and saw police everywhere and threw the bundle down because he didn't want to get caught red-handed with a murder weapon in his hands. And he went to his car and sped away. That's not what Knipe said he saw. Knipe's statement to the Memphis Police Department that evening, I have a copy of it, says he heard the clunk. He went to the front of his store. He opened the door. He saw the green bundle laying there. And he said, I looked out. I looked south and I looked north and the street was vacant. So there wasn't a massive police presence. It makes for a good story that Ray took the shot, was running back to the car, police everywhere. He threw the stuff down and empty-handed, he gets away. Knipe said there was nobody in the street at all. So even if Ray did it, he would have had no motivation. It would have been stupid, incredibly stupid, to throw the murder weapon down when you can see your car and there's nobody in the street looking at you. You would take that murder weapon and get out of Dodge, right? Well, that was Knipe's sworn statement to the Memphis Police Department.
Just the fact that that radio with his prison number on it, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. And then, like you mentioned, they'll bring up people like Posner and that to just tell you how the Warren Commissioner, or in this case, even the investigation from HSCA, they said, yeah, oh, well, everybody go back to sleep.
Right. Nothing to see here. Well, of course, the other thing that I discovered that I think is of monumental importance, because a federal court later determined in Ray's appeal process that it was, quote, central and determinative. Okay, that's big words for a judge to write down in a court opinion. He wrote that, the federal judge wrote that, based on a doctored transcript. There are two transcripts of Ray's guilty plea hearing. It lasted less than 4 minutes, and it was ambiguous at best. But then that transcript was transcribed that afternoon. I've talked to at least two people who were in the courtroom that day waiting for it, including Jim Squires, who went on to be the publisher of the Chicago Tribune. And wrote a book with about the King assassination and some other assassinations with John Siegenthaler, might be a name that some of your listeners may know. So, and there's an audio tape, and I found all of this in the Shelby County Archives. Got the audio tape, got the transcript. Ray is asked the question by Judge Preston Battle, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's fairly close, has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used against you to get you to plead guilty? Okay, pretty straightforward question. Ray answered, not with an answer, with a question. He said, now, what did you say? Judge Battle, apparently, was so obsessed with the process and with the prospects of, we're going to get this guy off my docket, we're going to get this guy out of the Shelby County Jail. He's going to be in Nashville by midnight, and let's don't let anything slow this down. He did not go back and say, Mr. Ray, would you answer the question about pressure? He just plowed on to the next question. Well, the transcript accurately recorded Ray's answer with the question about pressure. Now, what did you say? In fact, Jim Squires put that transcript in his book when it was published. And there was another guy in the courtroom that day associated with the Saturday Evening Post. They had a book ready to go, and all they did was add the transcript as an appendix. So you had two published books plus an audio tape that showed that Ray never answered the question about pressure. Yet there's an alternate transcript that has the answer for Ray. Has any pressure of any kind, anyone, any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? It says, no, no one in any way. That was introduced by the Shelby County DA's office, district attorney's office, as evidence in Ray's subsequent hearing, in which the court denied his motion to withdraw his plea and to stand trial. That transcript made it into all of the federal court cases. That transcript made it into the House Select Committee on Assassinations as the answer Ray gave, when it is definitively, positively true that the answer they say he gave, he did not give. Now, I'm going to ask you, Lynn, you never heard of Alamo, Tennessee. It's about a town of about 2,400 people here. If a one-man band from Alamo, Tennessee, with no book advance, no graduate students to help, if I can find that there are two transcripts and then determine which one is the real one, what do you think happened to the House Select Committee on Assassinations?
Well, they didn't really want to know the truth.
They didn't want to know the truth. They had their man. They didn't have the next guy on their list, if they had discredited Ray as the possible assassin, was nobody. They didn't have anybody on their list. There wasn't anybody else. And the House Select Committee even put in their bibliography a whole list. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that in their final report. They got a whole list, published sources by the time they began their investigation when the committee stood up in 1976. They list these two books. They list these two books who had the transcripts correct in them. So either they lied that they didn't review those books when they said they did, or they found that, we've got a real problem here, and they just ignored that issue altogether.
Yeah, or another word for it is obfuscate, where
absolutely.
Put up so many other things that people just say, well, I
don't have time to look into everything. So we'll take your word for all the little things. Of course, he admitted that. Right. And then the public just says, well, I guess these guys are doing their job.
Right. Right. That's what we're supposed to believe. But as I got into the details of the House Select Committee, and as a matter of fact, they have additional alterations of the true transcript that they've included in their final report or in the appendix volumes. I've forgotten whether it's in the appendix volumes or the final report. I mean, 26 appendix volumes is somewhere in the official report, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I found another five or six alterations that they made. Each and every one of them made Ray, implicated Ray more than the truthful transcript. And by the way, Lynn, I chased down the guy who actually typed the transcript that day in March of 1969, and his supervisor who reviewed it before, and I have affidavits from both of those people that we did not alter the transcript, the sound recording that they based the transcript off of. It says, now, what did you say? They put in their transcripts, and they swore that that's what they put in their transcripts. And then a month later, 6 weeks later, something like that, this other answer of has any pressure been used on? Has anybody used any pressure of it? No, no one in any way. And those copies of those affidavits are also in my book, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King.
I think just once you size up the character of James Earl Ray and then you see the scope of the crime, you realize that the two things don't fit at all. And then when you realize, when you've got these affidavits, that they didn't change anything, that's when you come to the conclusion of a deep state. Like somebody going to the printer then had to be on top of this case and doing it without leaving too many fingerprints. So it looks like everything is on the up and up, but yet when you get the printed version, and then who has time to go through that, right? It's
right,
just like
right.
With the Warren Commission, they left it all unindexed. So if you went through 26 volumes, you couldn't look up anything, you know?
Right, right. Exactly. I'll tell you, there was a very humorous and rewarding moment during my research. The criminal court clerk in Shelby County at that time was a fellow who went by the nickname Bubba. It was Bubba Blackwell. He had been the criminal court clerk for a number of years, and continued in that role for several years, quite a few years, I think, after the King assassination and the Ray case. And when I found him, he agreed to receive me and to look at what I had and help me determine. He recognized, oh, there's another transcript. That's a serious thing. Yeah, sure, I'll help you see if we can straighten this out. And by that time, well, Bubba Blackwell has since passed away. He was about 90, I guess, when I interviewed him, probably in about 2013, 2014, something like that. I knocked on the door of his home. His wife ushered me in. We sat down, and he said, you know, he said, when I retire, he pulled out this huge legal length transcript. He said, when I retired, I had kept this one transcript in my desk for all those years. And this is the only thing I brought home with me. And we flipped to the page, which, by the way, was typed on a different typewriter. the altered transcript was. When we flipped to the page where Judge Battle is asking Ray these questions before accepting his guilty plea, or as part of the acceptance of his guilty plea, I had also played the recording for him that I had on my laptop of what was actually said in the courtroom. And I had him look at the altered transcript. And he went down with his index finger of his right hand, syllable by syllable, the whole page. And we got down to, has any and he's listening to this and looking at the altered transcript and looking at his transcript that was generated that day, and he kept a copy in his desk for all those years. And of course, it was published in these two books I mentioned. And in listening to it, he gets down to the, has any pressure, has anyone used any pressure on you in any way to get you to plead guilty? And he gets to the altered transcript that says, no, no one in any way. He stops. He says, that's not what he said. So there's no way that one person, and I was pretty diligent in my research about this book. Let's just say there's no way that a single diligent person without resources, without connections, without a book advance, without graduate students who are working on their master's thesis in history or whatever, there's no way that I could find that and 100 government lawyers working for the Congress, Committee of the Congress of the United States couldn't.
You know, in such an important line, you know, I mean, if you look, that's where it starts right there.
Absolutely. And that was what federal judge Cluer Morton, once Ray had exhausted his state appeals process, they kicked it into the federal courts. And Judge Morton said, there's nothing more definitive about whether this guilty plea is constitutionally sound and legitimate than Ray's own words, because he was asked the question and he specified this question with the doctored answer. Has anyone in any way used any pressure on you to get you to plead guilty? And Cluer Morton quotes, no, no one in any way. And he said that was Ray's own words. And he decided that that is, quote, central and determinative that the guilty plea is constitutionally legitimate. Of course, the judge didn't know that that was a doctored transcript that he was looking at.
Well, it's an awful case from top to bottom. And then, you know, then you get into how many more other times has this happened?
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Do you have a website, by the way?
I do not.
Okay.
But let me throw out one more thing, Lynn, that might have been overlooked by a lot of people, because I haven't really seen this in writing yet, other than in my book, The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King. In the Trump and Biden era document releases before this big dump based on the executive order of January of this year. So the 2017 through 2022, I believe it is, data dumps by the National Archives, I discovered this accusation in a CIA document that Ray, when he was in Mexico, and the FBI originally traced him down to Puerto Vallarta in the western part of on the west coast of Mexico, not all that far from Los Angeles, where he went after he visited Puerto Vallarta, that there's this accusation that James Earl Ray, an eighth grade dropout, visited the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. Now, does that remind you of another controversial Cuban embassy visit of a few years before that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost comical.
Yeah. They, and the pictures that are grainy, they were too grainy to include in my book, unfortunately. That wouldn't have been a worthwhile image, but.
Well, it would have to be because it would show that it never happened.
Well, sure. These weren't Ray. These weren't even remotely looking like Ray. Yet here's this, in my mind, discredited accusation that Lee Oswald went down to Mexico City and was seen going into the Cuban embassy, or was accused of going into the the Cuban embassy. And now some of these more recent releases show they've accused James Earl Ray of the same thing, which messes up, by the way, that messes up the government's storyline and the government timeline. So that one got buried from 1969 until about 2021 when it was released, 2021, 2022.
Well, you know, it's a tried and true propaganda. If they got away with it last time, just use it again.
But sure. Although there are these eerie similarities, you know, both Ray and Lee Oswald had connections to various disreputable people in New Orleans. They did both go to Mexico. They're accused of colluding with the communists by going to the Cuban embassy. And so I'm not sure what to make of that yet. I really haven't settled on that in my mind. I'm not sure what point they might have had, unless there's a whole series of people out there, Lynn, who were potential patsies, who were on the string. We never heard of them because they never needed to pull the string, right? Who they routinely have a whole stable of accusations to pull on them. I don't know.
Well, it does seem with this, when you look into the dark side of MK Ultra and mind control and people that are set up to be a patsy or right. been hypno-programmed, then they have no memory of certain things. You know, that's the deep state. That's the, right. You know, military-industrial complex, as we were warned about.
Oh, absolutely. Eisenhower hit the nail on the head. And one other thing I might interject here, Lynn. I also interviewed Ray's brother, Jerry, who survived until about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, when Jerry died. Jerry's an interesting fella. Jerry led mostly a life of crime, as did all the males and related to Ray that we know of. But none of these are sophisticated people. None of these are going to be able to track and stalk probably one of the most well-known people in the entire world at that time.
Years from now, and I mean this in jest ahead of time, we're going to find out that that Thomas Matthew Crooks guy who took a shot at Trump, right? Yeah, we're going to find out that he went to Mexico City beforehand.
Well, I'm laughing.
Yeah,
you offered it in humor. It's a serious topic. I apologize for laughing, but who knows?
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, that's what I meant by that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that you've written this book and you have some inside information that people would not know of, except for your tenacity as a reporter and an uncle who had something to kind of tip the hat and say, hey, there's more to this story. You should look into it.
Oh, yeah.
That's very good. And
by the way, he was fired after 2 months by Governor Ellington. He had been appointed commissioner by two successive governors, including Ellington. But Ellington told him to stop the investigation. He didn't, and they fired him.
And that reminds me of Judge Joe Brown, right? He said, yeah. I'm going to look into this. We're going to test the gun, and I'm going to go on holiday for 2 weeks. When he comes back, he's been fired, and somebody said, look, we're giving you a new job. You can go on TV. Just move to LA. And so, you know, and pluck, when you talk about Jerry Ray, I also think about Robert Oswald, the brother. I think, oh, these guys, somebody came up to them and said, look, we just killed your brother. You're next if you don't play ball. So here, take this book advance. Just go along with the story.
Oh, yeah.
I never put too much into any revelations they have.
Right, right.
Okay, well then, I'm hoping that we have influenced people to pick up your book. We'll make links to where it's available. Before we wrap up, is there anything you want to bring up I didn't get to? We can't bring up the whole book, but I just want people to know that something recommended, and you can read an excerpt on Kennedys and King. So we'll make a link to that as well.
I'll mention one other thing very briefly, Lynn. When Ray escaped the largest manhunt in the history of North America and got out of Memphis, got to Atlanta, got from Atlanta to Toronto, and obtained a Canadian passport, he did so with an Ontario birth certificate, obviously not issued to him, but a legitimate Ontario birth certificate issued to someone else, who happened to be a Toronto policeman, by the way. That birth certificate was issued, was dated the same day that the Canadian national government, their Department of State, or Ministry of State, I guess, issued the passport. Now, I've got a copy of the approved passport application in my book, and I've got a copy of the province of Ontario birth certificate in my book. They're dated the same day.
So the fix is in.
Yep.
That's a shame. And, you know, when you look into something you're supposed to respect, like the FBI, the Justice Department, they have failed at every avenue. Just
miserably failed. It's hard not to conclude that a lot of these failures were deliberate, and that maybe more than just somebody giving a command, maybe some other people down the line knew in their heart of hearts, this is not right, and I got to keep my job.
That's the poverty of the situation, that it's taken just concerned citizens like yourself, you're saying, to look into this and find out that these transcripts have been altered. If they're altered, why? And then, you know, even the heads, I found out that the heads of the House Select Committee on Assassinations and even the Assassination Records and Review Board, they were just going along with things. They thought Lee Oswald did it. And they're, you know, it was to the tenacity of some of the junior investigators to pull up some evidence. Otherwise, they would have just laid the blanket over the whole thing and made it go away.
Absolutely. That's it.
Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for taking time to speak to me today. I hope everyone will have an interest in this. Pick up your book. We'll make links to that. The book is The Deep State Assassination of Martin Luther King. And, you know, I think people listening to the show have already have, you know, doubts, concerns that what the government has been saying has not been true. And books like this will help point out, just give people ammunition to look into this.
Absolutely. And with the House Select Committee, the King assassination part of it, of course, there was a JFK investigation. Also, the King part of it is the soft underbelly of the House Select Committee. They completely discredited themselves. If they are without ethics and completely discredited on one half of the on one half of their investigation, you gotta bet it's on both sides.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to anything new that you have coming up, and I'll be glad to talk to you again in the near future. So once again, thank you for writing this book, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate it.
Okay, good night.